Imani Skowacki is a local jewelry designer. Her mom came here from England with her parents in the 1950s on a ship, the SS United States.
Coming to the U.S. was coming to the land of milk and honey, where the streets are paved in gold.
We don't necessarily think of Europe first and foremost when we're talking about people picking up and leaving home in search of a better life. But in the 1950s, Europe had just been devastated by two world wars.
It was a turbulent time, even in the 50s, and kind of a gray and dark time. And there weren't as many opportunities for tradespeople who were wanting to raise their families. And so my grandparents decided to come to the U.S. There was a need, there was an influx of people actually in the 1950s who came over on ocean liners.
The story of their journey took on new meaning for Imani when her grandparents died. She and her mom were going through their belongings when they came across some mysterious garments.
We found corsets and we found petticoats and hidden pockets in corsets and petticoats and hidden pockets in linings of dresses. And I asked my mom, what are all these little hiding places for? And she told me the story of when they came over from Europe to, or from England specifically to the U.S. The few things that they had that were of great importance, you kept close to yourself. You didn't pack in a suitcase and leave in your room, in the ship. You kept those things close to your heart. And so my grandmother spent time sewing these little pockets into the clothing, and that's how they transported a strand of pearls. There's a beautiful ring, coins.
As a jewelry designer, Imani was intrigued by the idea of jewels you wouldn't display. This whole idea that for poor people on a ship, the most valuable things you have would be hidden. That was actually the inspiration behind a new collection she debuted at the West 18th Street Fashion Show just last month. So a journey three people made across the Atlantic in the 1950s. That journey is visible in art being made here in Kansas City in 2018.
Everything I do has this idea of family portrait. There's always my family kind of backing me up in the materials or the things that I bring with me. And there's comfort in that.
For immigrants, art can be a comfort. It can be a reason to leave or a reason to keep going. Art can be a home that no one can take away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're telling immigration stories from the local arts community, starting with Fidencio Fifield Perez. Hi, Fidencio.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. I know that you're on vacation visiting your parents, and it's great to hear your voice, though.
Likewise. Thank you for having me again.
Well, until you were about 7, you lived in Mexico. Tell me about your life there.
Right. So it felt pretty normal to me. I think we all grow up and don't really think about the conditions into which we're brought up. We just live. And only now in asking my mother about conditions, do I realize that we were really poor. We would go sometimes without eating. But still, through all of that, through being poor, you still had times where like you would play outside or play through the trees and stuff. But yeah, so in my mind, it was idyllic, but I know for everyone else, it wasn't, all the grown-ups.
And you, your mom harvested flowers and made bouquets, and you helped her with that?
Mm-hmm. So it actually goes, it goes back, I think, like 2-3 generations of women in my family planting and harvesting and then selling these bouquets and flowers at the markets in Oaxaca. And so I have vivid memories of smelling eucalyptus plants and helping my mother any way that I could, try to make little flimsy bouquets in order to help her. For me, it was just a task, something to pass time. But only now, again, do I realize that it was a way that we were trying to just maintain, gather some funds, but also like stay above the water, essentially.
You know, Your mom made a very risky decision to take you and your brother across the border into the U.S. What do you know about why she wanted to do that?
She did, and I love her for it. She sacrificed so much and gave up so much for her children, and she did that. She did that act because of love. She wanted, like many other mothers out there, wanted to give their children something better than they had or that they were born into. And so she made the awful and really terrifying decision to cross that border and bring me here. Yeah.
What was it about your situation in Mexico? I mean, mm-hmm. you've mentioned that you went sometimes without eating. Were there other mm-hmm. things that made it just untenable for her to imagine staying with you?
Absolutely. So we all know that the peso dropped. A lot of things just went into chaos after NAFTA. And for us, it looked like not being able to sell a produce at times. And also the level, specifically where we came from, the levels of corruption in Oaxaca were just immense. There's story upon story of some official gathering all the funds for education or something and just leaving town with them. And then also on a smaller scale, it looked like drinking water that, you know, you could tell that there were insects and bugs in, and my mother, she didn't want that for her children, and I can't fault her for it. And yeah, so it's many things. It's large scale corruption, the threat of people breaking into our home, which they did. And then also like trying to give her children something better. Food and education-wise.
Yeah, I mean, when we talked about this before, you described your journey across the border from very much a kid's perspective. You talked about this network of helpers along the way, including, like, the specific person who stands out is a mean lady who gave you too mm-hmm. many beans to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had a nickname for her.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I don't know that the adults also knew her name. I mean, everyone just called her Tia Frijoles, and I imagine it was out of security. But it was also because
Aunt Beans is how you translate that. Yeah,
mm-hmm. It was the only thing that she would give us to eat. So we would go all day just eating beans for breakfast and maybe another meal. Yeah.
What can you say about just what that journey felt like to you from your memory of it? I mean, I know you were really mm-hmm. young.
I just knew that we were going to the other side. Where we lived, we were surrounded by mountains. And any sense of where we were going, people would just tell me, you're going to the other side of the mountains. And so when I got here, to the U.S., I looked for those mountains, funny enough, and they weren't there, but...
Like in your rear view.
Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it also, I remember a lot of the sensory elements. I remember the sun, the sounds of snakes, and all the brambles and trees that stick out in my mind. And also just the sense of always being in fear. Since we crossed that border, I knew very much the weight of it. And I don't know, I grew up really fast in that trip, and I learned to just be really fearful of anyone in uniform, but all of that comes from the act of crossing. But yeah, so there's quite a, it's a mix of sensory things that I remember, but also the first time really feeling like the weight of it.
You've mentioned that you felt like you were always in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, that's part of just maneuvering through the whole thing. You're in the dark, whether it be in a car or in reference to Tia Frijoles, you're in the dark in a room, in a safe house, where you're not allowed to go out and you're not allowed to be seen by anyone. And so you're just always in dark, and you're allowed to only leave the house or move on once it's dark. You're always just traveling in the dark. And so at times it very much felt like we left at night, and then we arrived at night in the U.S. And that might be also why sometimes I have a hard time sort of remembering visual things.
You know, you grew up in North Carolina and really quickly established yourself as that kid in the class who made art. Do you remember how that happened?
I do. I have to give credit to the amazing educators that are here in North Carolina. I came to the U.S. and it would have been so easy for someone to have said, like, he doesn't know English and to just have given up. But my second grade teacher, Miss Ward, she took it upon herself to, like, connect with me somehow. So she went out of her way and bought me my first coloring book, the first coloring book I ever had. And she gave it to me. And I didn't know what I was looking at first. And then she gave me, like, Crayola little markers. And I just started to color, essentially, so that, one, I wouldn't lose track that I was doing something with the rest of the class, that I didn't just sit there. But two, this coloring book had words. And so while I was coloring, I would hopefully learn English words and try to communicate with my peers and the teacher. And it worked. Maybe in a more visual way. Immediately after second grade, my third grade teacher took note, and so she let me decorate her bulletin board. And then from then on, every other teacher just knew that I was the art kid, and it went on into middle school and then high school, and it all goes back to that coloring book. And in high school, again, amazing educators took me into their office and said, you need to apply to college. And that was the first time that I came out, actually, as undocumented. And the incredible guidance counselor that I had at Laney High School convinced me to really try it. And eventually I ended up going to college for this thing that, again, goes back to that coloring book.
It was what, Bugs Bunny?
It was, yeah.
You know, I wonder if that identity as the art kid was kind of important to you also, just that it would have been so easy for you to have an identity that hinged totally on your status as an immigrant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Somehow, I see friends of my brother maybe that didn't have something that people saw in them, and many people dropped out of high school, and I think of how privileged I was that someone saw something in me and really, really tried to get it out, because I don't think that I saw that in myself also. I worry sometimes. I think, what would have happened if I hadn't had that teacher that gave me that coloring book? I don't know that I would have ended up going to college or eventually be an artist full time and then an educator myself.
You know, so I'm going to jog forward in your story. I mean, you now have a master's degree in painting. You're married to a guy you met in Chicago. You've lived in this country since you were 7, and you're applying for DACA. And part of that is that your mom saved this shoebox full of art that you made and clippings in the school newspapers about the art you made. And that turns out it's part of your DACA application.
It is, absolutely. I should mention that I met my husband John actually in Iowa City.
Oh, sorry.
While we were both doing our masters, and that's sort of where this new project sort of started in meeting him, but also starting this collection of series of paintings on envelopes. But yeah, going back to DACA, the government asked me, when I applied for it, the government asked me to present evidence, physical evidence, that I myself had been living in this country. So it was upon undocumented youth to sort of present that we were here. And so luckily, my mother had the shoebox of all the certificates and newspaper articles that spoke about me being the comic book artist in my elementary school or middle school. And she took all these certificates and handed them to me and said, give this to the lawyer. You don't really have to justify where you've been all these years, because these papers and these newspapers and certificates will do that for you.
But
and so
what I love about that is she was not collecting those things for bureaucratic reasons.
Yeah, she wasn't. I think for her, it was something else. It was proof that everything she had given up these papers and documents prove that we were doing something. We were fulfilling the dream that she had.
The show you have up right now, and you've kind of hinted at this, it's at a gallery in the Crossroads. It's called Documents, and you've painted mm-hmm. plants on envelopes. Can you explain that?
Yes. So it starts about 2 years ago when I was trying to reapply for DACA, and I was away in Texas doing an artist residency, and I was away from my now husband and my friends, my family, and the election happened, and I really didn't know what to do. I found myself in a new state where I didn't know a lot of people, and in a place where I really just didn't understand or know or could feel like I could connect with my neighbors. And so I had this moment of like wanting to stop making art, and because I think the weight of what the government was asking of me of reapplying to DACA, and I had so many envelopes, and I thought, I really just want to paint something simple. And the first envelope that I painted was from an envelope that had come from my husband, who was away at the time. And that sort of, I realized that what I wanted to do was paint these envelopes that are supposed to represent so much of my life, with things that I surround myself with, which are plants that I've collected during my time in the Midwest, while I was in graduate school, once I left for Chicago, once I got the residency in Texas. All of these plants are an actual map of me traversing through the U.S. and their mappings of time and of relationships. And I thought, what better way to humanize those envelopes that say nothing about me than by painting these plants that I really love and care for and feel like I can really protect in a time where I myself don't maybe feel protected as much.
The idea of like potted plants surrounding a person, that seems like such a symbol of having a home, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it goes back to in Mexico, where just being surrounded. My mother had so many plants also, and she would have them around the house. And I have to believe that it all is connected again to something bigger than myself. But yeah, so once I moved out for college and graduate school, I collected all these plants and again surrounded myself with plants that I could just pick up, put in my car, and drive the next time that I needed to move.
Do you feel, I don't know, I mean, thinking about the plant metaphor, do you feel rooted now?
No. And I think that's why I'm still making them, because I still feel like things could be pulled from underneath me. I mean, we saw that DACA is on its last legs. Me and my husband don't know if we'll stay in the U.S. And so, no, I don't. I would say not. Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. When you think about this show, Documents, I mean, that mm-hmm. phrase, the word you've created, documents, mm-hmm. what does it mean to you?
It means many things. And I think that's why I really like the title. It means these envelopes, again, that are supposed to represent so much that...
they have things like diplomas, but also immigration status stuff.
Absolutely. And they just come in the mail as if nothing. And the envelope, you just, after its purpose, you essentially just throw it away. It's done its work. And I think that is how we talk about immigrants. Also, people are used for their labor and then their purpose, and then they're just thrown out for the next wave. And so I really, again, I wanted to, I think back of like why I collected the envelopes, and when my master's degree came in the mail, I was living in Chicago by myself, and no one was there to like celebrate with me. And my mother wasn't there, and she had given up so much for me to just receive this one envelope. And I didn't have the heart to throw it away, and I just collected it. And again, it goes back to just collecting these things that represent so many nightmares and hopes. And yeah, hopefully that comes across in the exhibition.
Fidencio Fifield-Perez, thank you for telling your story, and enjoy your vacation.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Documents is on view through this month at Garcia Squared, an art gallery in the Crossroads. And in just a minute, the curator of that show will tell his own story. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we just heard from an artist who came across the U.S.-Mexico border as a child. A shoebox full of his art, saved by his mom, found its way into his DACA application not too long ago. He has a show right now in a local gallery, and his connection with the guy who runs the place has to do with more than art. Israel Garcia of the Garcia Squared Gallery in the Crossroads, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me again.
So your story and Fidencio's actually have a lot in common.
Yeah, I think, you know, with Fidencio, I've had the gallery for 6 years, and I've curated for over 15. But, you know, for me, I make it a point to keep track of artists that have some sort of, or are talking about their immigrant experience. And I think with Fidencio, and the gallery has focused in that way as well, just always really telling great stories. With Fidencio, I think it was really the first time as an artist myself, as in a curator, it was the first time that our work, our independent work, was so similar and it kind of hit home.
You crossed the border with your mom about 10 years before Fidencio. Tell us the story of how you got here, your journey.
Yeah, well, mine is actually, you know, as I was listening to Fidencio speak, and, you know, like you said, there's always little details that are different, even though Fidencio and I have talked about the experiences before. It was very similar, you know. There was always, for myself, is Michoacan, which is kind of 2 hours off of west of Mexico City. And it was really the same scenario. You know, we really didn't understand our poverty then. You know, there was no sense of us feeling that. We felt that we struggled, but it seemed like everybody else was struggling as well. And we always worked as kids. We did sold stuff on the streets or one thing or another. So we were always trying to make ends meet. I know that it became harder for us. You know, I think one memory that sticks out, I remember only having sugar water to eat and drink at that time.
And then you crossed the border in a car while pretending to be asleep?
Yeah, it seemed like that was a scenario that, you know, I think for myself and my 7-year-old memories, it seemed like that's the way I remembered. I remember, you know, at some point getting into a vehicle, and then just, you know, being told to, you know, fall asleep or go to bed, and because our parents weren't with us anymore. So we were being, you know, basically hand off to friends and family that were assisting our parents in the transition, basically. And like I said, I think I don't remember. What I do remember being vivid in some sense was the morning after, or what I think it's the morning after, is just waking up in this foreign place to me.
What you saw there, so this is the morning after you've crossed the border, and you've been asleep or pretending to be asleep, and you see some toys, and that's what really tells you, I'm definitely in the United States now.
Yeah, for me, I knew it was, everything was different. It wasn't, you know, our dirt floors anymore, for example. It was Transformers in this case, which I had no idea what they were, and it happened to be that the home that we kind of woke up in is, you know, there were just very, these kids had all the collection of Transformers. I think in the mid-80s, it was pretty popular. So they had the whole collection, and we happened to wake up to this body of toys.
But those did not end up being the toys you normally played with in your childhood, even in the U.S.
No, it definitely didn't. I think for our case, my dad is a welder and a carpenter, so we were having the homemade toys. You know, we were getting a foot of a chair being transformed into an animal or something. So it was always handmade toys. But yeah, definitely, even in California, I can't remember ever having new toys. It was always thrift store trips or something like that, where it was hand-me-downs.
Like Fidencio, you were saving a lot of documentation as you grew up, but your mom actually did know that that might be useful in terms of you getting legal status, at least a legal residency. You had plans to seek asylum under a program that existed back then, but that the window of opportunity expires when you turned 21?
Yeah, and the great thing is that even though our stories or our experiences are 10 years apart, you know, we were lucky in a sense to say that my mom was able to get her status through an amnesty. She was a farm worker. And that's how she was able to get her status. And once she was able to, she was able to petition for us as her children. So that's really kind of the process that it took. But I think, you know, I say luckily on our sense because there was an amnesty at the place that gave her, opened the door for her. But in our case, it's even though it's possibly the best case scenario, it still took 33 years.
Yeah, this story is so wild of what happens. I mean, your mom saved all kinds of things, but got defrauded 4 times by people who either genuinely trying to help or maybe just claiming to try and help.
Right, yeah. And I think just like Fidencio, you know, there's always this network of friends and family or friends of the family that give you a sense of direction or what to do, what should you do, or what should you save. And I think that was really the notion where my parents, even though our accomplishments, she was as proud of them as well, but I think it became more about saving specific things that showed proof that we were here. In our case, we realized that through these 4 times that my mom was defrauded, my parents were defrauded, that in that process, we were losing evidence, basically.
So you were submitting a lot of evidence that you had been here as a child to what, immigration lawyers, nonprofits?
Right. So by that point, it was really just like it is today, you know, just non-for-profits that either have a lawyer on staff or someone that's walking you through the application process and really taking on your information and then, you know, promising to fill out the paperwork. You pay their fee. And then you would come back or at some point months after you would hear back from them. And I think, you know, we would basically go through that process is basically provide the information, pay our fee, and then never hear back or find out that this not-for-profit was fraudulent. And then, you know, they were raided by the FBI or whatever the case is, may have been, and then find out that the paperwork was never filed to begin with.
And so then you lose the stuff. And how, I mean, you've told me the story of going back and trying to get old yearbooks after going through this process, for example. I mean, how do you recreate the evidence of your childhood?
Well, and I think that was the case. I think, you know, for myself, it was just really understanding that there's a paper trail that existed. And really making an effort. I think I talked about with my wife about a story that was very interesting to me. I think after 15 years of being out of high school, I happened to call back my middle school. I as a kid, you know, we worked at the candy store because it just kind of gave us some funds for ourselves to kind of give our mom. But the store manager at the time, and this was Nimitz Middle School, and he remembered me. And I think that was such a happy moment that somebody remembered me at the time, you know, at middle school where I just thought that I was walking through life kind of through the shadows. And to find out that somebody remembered me. And he went above and beyond to, like, find my 3 years of middle school's yearbooks and send them to me.
Wow. The story gets even crazier when you've missed the 21-year-old cutoff where you can get asylum under this former program. And so you're in Kansas City at this point as an adult. the last person you contacted, you just never heard back from. You're 21 now, it's too late. And for 10 years you lived that way, but then you walked into the offices at a local organization and the craziest stuff starts happening.
Yeah, and you know, and it was one of those things where that there isn't a standard process of how to go about it. You know, if your mom is petitioning for you, then you have a window of time, which is under before the age of 21, where your mom can petition for you. After that, you have to file as an adult, and it takes twice that long. But yes, I walked into this not-for-profit out of just frustration of my own situation. By this point, it was kind of, I would say, 2010 or so. And I just really wanted to be informed of my situation because I kind of was frustrated and just kind of gave up. And walked into this not-for-profit, told them my story just like I am doing now, and talked to them about the lawyer, the last lawyer that we had dealt with. And it so happened that this lawyer happened to have some of her archives before she disappeared. There with JVS, I guess she had held an office there. And her these archives just ended up there.
And this happens to be the place that you've walked into.
Right. And it just, I mean, out of, I would say, 10 places that I could have walked into, this happened to be the one. Gave them my name, gave them my mom's name. And luckily enough, they came back telling me that my original application was approved and then just set in their office.
You had been approved as a legal resident of the United States, but just no one mailed you the letter.
Correct.
And it happened to be sitting in the basement of the place you walked into.
Right. And I think for me, it was, I was really mad, I think. I think the initial feeling was just overwhelmed of anger and knowing that this letter could have changed 10 years of my life drastically.
Yeah, tell me about those 10 years.
Well, I think it was one of those things where, you know, once again, I think I happened to be very lucky in the sense that I was able to move forward through my career and through what I was doing as an artist as well, being able to exhibit and being able to create work. But I think it you know, it's just how this one status changes so much of what you're able to do. You know, there's, you're not able to file for legal aid, for example. You know, there's no social services that you could apply for. So life just became complicated, really, and everything was happened to be out of pocket.
How do you think that these experiences have shaped the way that you've participated in Kansas City's art scene, or maybe sometimes the way you haven't?
Well, and I think it's both. I think it's definitely made me who I am. You know, I don't think I would necessarily change it in any way, because I think I did work harder because of it. And I think, you know, there was always this sense of looking forward. And I think it's common within our community. You know, I think that we realize the situation that we're in. We realize that it's not an easy one, but we are a hardworking community. And I think that's one thing that we've continued throughout. And I think it's luckily for me, not only did I exist in Kansas City's art community, I pushed myself through that door.
What does the show that's on display now at your gallery, Documents, what does it mean to you?
Well, I think to me, I think it was a great, it's a great show and a great show for me to be able to exhibit. I think Fidencio and I, you know, I met him when he first exhibited here in Kansas City at the Artist Coalition, and just really kept track. And I think for me as a curator and as an artist, it's being able to keep track of these artists that I know their storytelling is so great. So, and I think that it's just another way to tell our story.
Israel Garcia, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Israel's gallery is Garcia Squared on West 18th Street. Up next, how a young student in Tiananmen Square in 1989 ended up making art here in Lawrence, Kansas. These are immigration stories on KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my next guest is Hong Chun Zhang, an artist living in Lawrence. She's been getting pretty well known on the national level for portraits of herself, her sisters, her daughters, depicting the long, straight black hair she equates with Asian identity. But when she was painting people with anonymous shoes of laborers where their faces should be, that was different. That was what she was doing when she first arrived in this country. The image of Mao Zedong would be a wallpaper behind these people. Her work was a lot more political back then, and we're about to find out why. Hong, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So talk to me. You were in Tiananmen Square in 1989. That is such an incredible thing.
Yes, when Tiananmen Square incident happened in June 4th, 1989, I was 17 years old, my senior year in high school. The reason I was able to participate in Tiananmen Square because of my school, the attached high school to Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing. It was very close to Tiananmen Square, only 10 minutes walking distance. When I was 15, my twin sister and I passed the national exam and left hometown, Shenyang, in the northeast to attend this boarding art high school in Beijing from 1986 to 1990. So we spent 4 years studying foundational courses. The student from Central Academy of Fine Arts Sculpture Department built the Goddess of Democracy, and we all marched to the Tiananmen Square and delivered the statues. So I have seen everything happened in front of me at the Tiananmen Square.
And what was that like for you? I mean, that there, this was a huge international moment, but oddly enough, I mean, people outside the square didn't even know what was happening.
I know. My most vivid memory is the night of the shooting and the week after. You know, I remembered in order to show our resistance to the Chinese government, more students actually were called to stay in the Tiananmen Square the night of the shooting. And there were millions of participants there at that night, and we were able only stayed outside of the crowd. You couldn't see anything happened from the center. No one expected the government would open fire to the students and Beijing residents. After we heard like a firecracker sound from the center, all of a sudden there were giant wave of people running towards us, and we had to run. Then I saw people who were running with me or in front of me fell down, and blood was everywhere. Then I heard a screaming sound. Then you realized it was a gunfire, not a firework. And the next day, on June 5th and the week after, there was a martial law. Everywhere was shut down in Beijing, including my school. So no one came to cook for us because we live in the boarding school. So we have to, you know, sneak out and make sure there was no tanks and gunshots on the street. Then we ran to a nearby convenience store to buy a instant noodle run by the local residents. Then we got a phone call from our principal and asked us to take a train to go back to our hometown and stayed there for another week until we got a call back to Beijing. So when we got home, my parents didn't know what happened because the media was controlled by the central government. No one outside of Beijing knew what was going on.
The you know, after that, you resumed your art studies and went up through the college level. But the martial law that came after Tiananmen Square, that persisted. And it created, it sounds like, just a really particular kind of environment to be studying art in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. After 1989, the Tiananmen Square incident, many Chinese intellectuals felt there was a very tight artistic restrictions and political environment. So they all left China to overseas to seek for political, artistic, and economic freedom, just looking for something different, something to look forward to it. When I was in CAFA, Central Academy of Fine Arts, as a student in late 80s and 90s, our art context and education was very restrictive. Students were only allowed to stay or study one single medium, and everyone kind of learned from the same realistic style that adopted from Soviet Union called realistic socialism. And we painted very safe subjects like flowers, birds, landscapes, and human figures. And many Western, we have very limited access to Western contemporary art, especially like installation, video, and performance art were not even introduced at that time. And yeah, that's part of the reason why I left China in 1996. Came with my twin sister together with the help from our older sister in Atlanta. Then we got a green card and stayed in the U.S.
You told me a story once about your final project for your bachelor's degree, where you had to submit a sketch of what you would be painting and get that approved. And there's one sketch that your advisor approved, one that was unapproved. Can you tell that story? Maybe the short version of it, since we're short on time, unfortunately.
Okay. From 1990 to 1994, I studied Chinese ink painting at the Central Academy of Fine Arts. In order to graduate, you have to have a thesis show. So my advisor have to prove my sketches before move to the next level. So I did two sketches. One is a little child holding a group of sheep around her. So it's very happy and a safe subject. The other one is something I really wanted, is painted a group of child jumping on the trampoline, but outside is like a protected barbed wires to show, even though single child policy happened in China, all the parents afraid the child will lose their safety, or the government actually created pressure for raise a single child. So that's the representation of the barbed wire. So that painting I was really wanted to show, but my advisor disapproved that sketch. Because of him left China for a visiting professor job in Japan. So I was able to show both pieces at my graduation
because
show.
He was away.
And, yeah, he was away. So ironically, the one he proved didn't get any prize, and the one I really liked it and win the award. So I was very happy to find a way to, you know, balance out my creativity, got a chance to show both. But if my advisor didn't left China or left Beijing, I don't think I had the opportunity to show both.
Yeah, the difference between a child surrounded by sheep and children jumping on a trampoline surrounded by barbed wire, that's a pretty big difference. But you've told the story of how you ended up in the United States. Your art when you first arrived here was very political. You were trying things you hadn't been able to try before.
Yes. the first series of called Three Generations. I still use the same medium, ink medium, but in a very small size. But the subject was changed. This series is more political. Gender overtone has a representational style and narrative approach to reflect Chinese women in three different generations, their suffering and joy during different period of time. So I use non-authorized image of high leaders, like a Mao's image.
So like before, you would not have been able to paint an image of Mao.
Yeah, those image was like a taboo, was not allowed to do in China. So this series is really gave me opportunity because of living in the U.S. to do something I wouldn't ever done in China, to allow me to release this bond of artistic restrictions from the Chinese government and Communist Party.
Do you think your art is so different now? It looks very different to me anyway. I mean, I'm sure that to you, you can see more continuity, but now you have these very long scrolls. I mean, longer than the length of a wall, that show the long black straight hair that you identify as part of the Asian and Asian American experience, especially for women. And that is, it's so stripped down and simple and symbolic. Simple, not in a bad way, just simple in terms of it's very pared down. Whereas these images, there are wallpaper of Mao Zedong with shoes in front of him, and women in bird cages, and lots of colors. It's, do you think that where you have arrived now, like you had to purge that other stuff?
I think definitely studying in U.S. Opens up many possibilities for my experiment in art. And also, like you said, the large hair series is really take on a bigger scale compared to my previous ink paintings or even the Three Generation series. I did this long hair series when I was in graduate school. So because my living and studying environment changed, I'm living in different culture, but still I have been, you know, thinking about me as a Chinese American female artist living in the U.S. was my cultural identity. So that's why the long hair themed subject came to life. I just wanted to, you know, draw a self-portrait of my family, starting out from my own and my twin sister, then move to with my twin sister and older sister, then included my daughter too. So the black and white, you really, you know, adopted from my Chinese ink painting trainings and aesthetic the format to do something that from, you know, use disembodied long hair, not refer to my identity, but also wanted to show the imposing and surreal quality of three-dimensional effect from two-dimensional work.
You know, what does the long black hair mean to you? I noticed, you know, your most recent ones show that long black hair in a tornado formation, which seems very Kansas.
Yeah. Well, at the beginning, I wanted to make a self-portrait, more personal identity using long hair. Then later I developed, you know, through the long hair, you see women in different culture. And through a broader theme of, you know, combined with my living environment. For example, the Kansas connection is for my tornado piece. I combine my own identity, long hair, with American Midwest environment to create this new series for my upcoming show at Hall Contemporary West Bottoms location this fall, from September 7th to November 7th during open spaces. So I plan to show a few charcoal drawings, also large installation pieces. So you can experience how you get inside of the tornado to see it, to experience it. So it give you a different physical experience. I even rented a studio space called Artist Art Emergency at Lawrence to create this piece. And the owner of the studio, Dalton Paley, he's going to help me to create a short film to document
Hong,
the process too.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, but we have to go now. Have a wonderful day, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for inviting me.
We just spoke with Hong Zhang, an artist in Lawrence. Tomorrow is First Friday. We'll be taking a look at some of the other stuff going on in town. Puppets doing Shakespeare, an artist residency at the Missouri State Fair. That's tomorrow at 10. This show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Coy Duggar and intern Trevor Hook. I'm Gina Kaufman.